The Population Myth by Murray Bookchin.
Section 1.
The population problem has a phoenix-like existence. It rises from the ashes at least every generation and sometimes every decade or so. The prophecies are usually the same, namely that human beings are populating the earth in unprecedented numbers and devouring its resources like a locust plague. In the days of the Industrial Revolution, Thomas Malthus, an unsavoury English parson, formulated his notorious law of population, which asserts that whilst food supplies expand only arithmetically, the population soars geometrically. Only by wars, famines, and disease, Malthus essentially argued, can a balance be struck between population and food supplies. Malthus did not mean this to be an argument to foster human welfare. It was an unfeeling justification for the inhuman miseries inflicted on the mass of English people by land-grabbing aristocrats and exploitative industrialists. True to the mean-spirited atmosphere of the times, Malthus opposed attempts to alleviate poverty because they would remove the limits imposed on population growth by prolonging the lives of the poor. Malthus's law entered into Darwin's explanation of evolution and re-emerged from biology as social Darwinism. Profounded vigorously in the US and England a generation later, this theory reduced society to a jungle, in effect in which a law of survival of the fittest justified the wanton plundering of the world by the wealthy, or the fittest, while the labouring classes, dispossessed farmers and third world savages, were reduced to penury, presumably because they were unfit to survive. The arrogance of bankers, industrialists and colonialists in the Gilded Age at the turn of the century, who dined on lavish dishes while starved bodies were collected regularly in the city streets of the Western world, all testified to a harsh class system that invoked natural law to justify the opulence enjoyed by the ruling few and the hunger suffered by the ruled many. Barely a generation later, Malthusianism acquired an explicitly racist character. During the early 20s, when Anglo-Saxon racism peaked in the US against darker peoples like Italians, Jews, and Eastern Europeans, the notion of biological inferiority led to explicitly exclusionary immigration laws that favoured Northern Europeans over other, presumably, subhuman peoples. Malthusianism, now prefixed with a neo to render it more contemporary, thoroughly permeated this legislation. Population in the US had to be controlled, and American cultural, read racial, purity had to be rescued, be it from the yellow peril of Asia or the dark peril of the Latin and Semitic worlds. Nazism did not have to invent its racial imagery of sturdy Aryans beleaguered by subhuman dark people, particularly Jews. Hitler saw himself as the protector of a Northern European culture from Hebraic superstitions, to use the juicy language of a contemporary well-known Arizona writer, a cultural issue that was riddled by fascist sociobiology. From Hitler's Northern European viewpoint, Europe was overpopulated in the 1930s, and the continent's ethnic groups had to be sifted out according to their racial background. Hence the gas chambers and crematoriums of Auschwitz, the execution squads that followed the German army into Russia in the summer of 1941, and the systematic and mechanized slaughter of millions in a span of 3 or 4 years. The phoenix rises again. One would have thought that the Second World War and the ugly traditions that fed into it would create a deeper sense of humanity and a more sensitive regard for life, non-human as well as human. Judging from the way the population problem has surfaced again, however, we seem even more brutalized than ever. By the late 1940s, before the wartime dead had fully decayed, the Neo-Malthusians were back at work, this time to object to the use of pesticides newly developed to eradicate malaria and antibiotics to control killing infections in the Third World. Even eminent biologists like William Vogt entered the fray, attacking modern medicine for preserving human life and predicting famines in Britain between 1948 and 1978, and imminent famine in Germany and Japan. The ugly debate was overshadowed by the Korean War and the blandly optimistic Eisenhower era, followed by the stormy 60s period with its message of idealism, public service, and, if you please, humanism. But the decade barely came to a close when neo-Malthusianism surfaced again, this time with grim books that warned of a population bomb and advocated an ethics of triage in which the nations that were recommended for US aid seemed uncannily to fall on the American side of the Cold War, irrespective of their population growth rates. Viewed from a distance of two decades later, the predictions made by many neo-Malthusians seem almost insanely ridiculous. We were warned, often in the mass media, that by the 1980s, for example, artificial islands in the oceans would be needed to accommodate growing population densities on the continents. Our oil supplies, we were told with supreme certainty, would be completely depleted by the end of the century. Wars between starving peoples would ravage the planet, each nation seeking to plunder the hidden food stores of the others. By the late 70s, this debate took a welcome breather, but it has returned again like a phoenix dressed in the plumage of ecology. Given the hysteria and the exaggerated predictions of earlier such debates, the tone today is a little calmer, but in some respects it is even more sinister. We have not been forced to turn our oceans into real estate, nor have we run out of oil, food, material resources, or neo-Malthusian profits. But we are acquiring certain bad intellectual habits, and we are being rendered more gullible by a new kind of religiosity that goes under the name of spirituality, with a new style paganism and primitivism. First of all, we are thinking more quantitatively than qualitatively now. All talk about wholeness, oneness, and interconnectedness to the contrary notwithstanding. When we are told that the population issue is merely a matter of numbers, as one zero population growth writer put it, then the vast complexity of population growth and diminution is reduced to a mere numbers game, like the fluctuations of Dow Jones stock market averages. Human beings turned into digits can thus be equated to fruit flies and their numbers narrowly correlated with food supply. This is following the Dow with a vengeance. Social research, as distinguished from the voodoo ecology that passes under the name of deep ecology these days, reveals that human beings are highly social beings, not simply a species of mammals. Their behavior is profoundly conditioned by their social status, as people who belong to a particular gender, hierarchy, class group, ethnic tradition, community, or historical era, or adhere to any of a variety of ideologies. They also have at their disposal powerful technologies, material resources, science, and a naturally endowed capacity for conceptual thought that provides them with a flexibility that few, if any, non-human beings possess, not to speak of mutable institutions and capacities for systematic group cooperation. Nothing here is more illusory than aiming to follow the Tao. The bad intellectual habits of thinking about demographic or even resource issues in a linear, asocial, and ahistorical manner tends to enter into all ecological problems, thanks very much to the neo-Malthusianisms and to a biocentrism that equates people to non-human life forms. Secondly, by reducing us to studies of line graphs, bar graphs, and statistical tables, the neo-Malthusians literally freeze reality as it is. Their numerical extrapolations do not construct any reality that is new, they merely extend, statistic by statistic, what is basically old and given. They are futurists, in the shallowest sense of the word, not utopians in the best sense. They teach us to accept society, behavior, and values as they are, not as they should or even could be. This procedure places us under the tyranny of the status quo and divests us of any ability to think about radically changing the world. I have encountered very few books or articles written by neo-Malthusians that question whether we should live under money economy or a statist system of society or be guided by profit-oriented behavior. There are books and articles aplenty that explain how to become a morally responsible banker, entrepreneur, landowner, developer, or for all I know, arms merchant. But whether the whole system called capitalism, be it corporate in the West or bureaucratic in the East, must be abandoned if we are to achieve an ecological society is rarely discussed. Thousands may rally around Earth First's idiotic slogan, back to the Pleistocene, but few conditioned by Neo-Malthusian thinking will rally around the cry of the left Greens, forward to an ecological society. Lastly, Neo-Malthusian thinking is most backward in thinking out the implications of its demands. If we are concerned today, and rightly so, about the sinister implications of registering AIDS victims, what are the totalitarian consequences of creating a Bureau of Population Control, as some zero population growth wits suggested in the early 1970s? Imagine what consequences would follow from increasing the state's power over reproduction. Indeed, what areas of personal life would not be invaded by slowly enlarging the state's authority over our most intimate relations? Yet such demands, in one form or another, have been raised by Neo-Malthusians on grounds that lack the mental level needed to examine the statistical abstract of the United States. The social roots of hunger. This arithmetic mentality that disregards the social context of demographics is incredibly short-sighted. If we live in a grow-or-die capitalistic society, in which accumulation is literally a law of economic survival, and competition is the motor of progress, anything we have to say about population causing the ecological crisis is basically meaningless. Under such a society, the biosphere will eventually be destroyed, whether 5 billion or 50 million people live on the planet. Competing firms in a dog-eat-dog market must outproduce each other if they are to remain in existence. They must plunder the soil, remove the Earth's forests, kill off its wildlife, and pollute its air and waterways. Not because their intentions are necessarily bad, although they usually are, hence the absurdity of the spiritualistic pablum in which Americans are currently immersed, but because they must simply survive. Only a radical restructuring of society as a whole, including its anti-ecological sensibilities, can remove this all-commanding social compulsion. Not rituals, yoga, or encounter groups, valuable as some of these practices may be, no least in improving one's earning capacity and power to command. But the most sinister feature of Neo-Malthusianism is that it actively deflects us from dealing with the social origins of our ecological problems. Indeed, places the blame for them on the victims of hunger rather than those who victimize them. If there is a population problem and famine in Africa, Neo-Malthusianism blames the ordinary people for having too many children or insisting on living too long, much as Malthus nearly two centuries ago blamed England's poor. The viewpoint not only justifies privilege and degrades its victims, it brutalizes the Neo-Malthusians as well. And frankly, they often lie. Consider the issue of population and food supply in terms of mere numbers, as we step on a wild merry-go-round that does not support Neo-Malthusian predictions of a decade ago, much less a generation ago. A typically Neo-Malthusian stunt is to try to determine the per capita consumption of steel, oil, paper, chemicals, and the like of a nation by dividing the total tonnage consumed by the national population, such that every man, woman, and child can be said to consume a resultant quantity. Gives us a picture that is blatantly false and functions as a sheer apologia for the upper classes. The steel that goes into constructing a battleship, the oil that is used to fuel the tank, and the paper that is used for ads hardly depicts the consumption of materials by ordinary people. Rather, the stuff is consumed by all the pentagons of the world that help keep a grow-or-die economy in operation. Goods, I may add, whose function is to destroy and whose destiny is to be destroyed. The shower of such data that descend upon us by Neo-Malthusian writers is worse than obscurantist. It is vicious as the shopping malls that dump their toxic consumer goods on us and the costly highways that converge upon them. To ignore the fact that we are victims of a vast, completely entrapping social order, which only a few can either control or escape from, is to literally deaden the political insight of ordinary people, whose wants, of course, are blamed for every dislocation in our ecological dislocations. On the demographic merry-go-round, the actual facts advanced by many Neo-Malthusians are no less misleading. In the West, particularly in countries like Germany, which Neo-Malthusian prophets of the late 1940s warned would soar in population well beyond food supplies, birth rates have fallen beyond the national replacement rate. This is true of Denmark, Austria, Hungary, and indeed much of Europe generally, including Catholic Italy and Ireland, where tradition, one would expect, would make for huge families. So traditions that foster large, predominantly male families, by which the high birth rates of India and China were explained, are not frozen in stone. The US, whose population the more hysterical Neo-Malthusians of some two decades ago predicted would be obliged to live on oceanic rafts, is approaching zero population growth, and, by now, it may be lower.
Footnote.
In fact, the most recent population is nothing less than startling. A report by the European Population Conference, released in March 1993, predicts that Europe's overall population will drop from 449 million to 342 million by the middle of the 21st century. Catholic Spain and Italy will drop their fertility rate from around the 2.1% they need to simply reproduce their population to 1.2%. In Greece, the fertility rate has declined already from 2.2% to 1.4% in only a decade. On the whole, Europe's population is expected in the next 50 years to decline by 100 million people, notwithstanding all the dire predictions on which Euro-Americans have been fed in the Malthusian literature of the past 30 years. Nor is food supply lagging behind overall population growth. Cereal production rose by 12% since 1975, making it possible recently for even Bangladesh to drastically reduce its grain imports. The markets of Western Asia are being flooded by Chinese corn. Even barren Saudi Arabia is selling off its accumulations of wheat. And in Finland, farmers are so overloaded with surplus wheat that they are turning it into mink fodder and glue. India, the so-called worst-case example, tripled its production of grain between 1950 and 1984. Its greatest problem at present is not population growth, but the transportation of food from grain surplus areas to grain shortage areas, a major source of many Indian famines in the past. Lester R. Brown of World Watch Institute divides the world into countries where population growth is slow or non-existent, and where living conditions are improving, and those where population growth is rapid and living conditions are deteriorating, or in imminent danger of doing so. One might easily conclude by the mere juxtaposition of Brown's phrases that declining living conditions are due solely to increasing population. Not so, if one looks closely at Brown's data, as well as other sources. Much of the disparity between population growth and bad living conditions in Bangladesh, India and Pakistan, for example, is due to patterns of land ownership. In southern Asia, some 30 million rural households own no land, or very little, a figure that represents 40% of nearly all rural households in the subcontinent. Similar figures are emerging from Africa and Latin America. Land distribution is now so lopsided in the third world in favour of commercial farming and a handful of elite landowners that one can no longer talk of a population problem without relating it to a class and social problem. It would take several volumes to untangle the mixed threads that intertwine hunger with land ownership, material improvements with declining population growth, technology with food production, the fragility of familial customs with the needs of women to achieve full personhood, internal civil wars, often financed by Western imperialists, with famines, and the role of the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund with patterns of food cultivation. Westerners have only recently gained a small glimpse of the role of the IMF and World Bank in producing a terrible famine in the Sudan by obliging the country to shift from the cultivation of food in areas of rich soil to the cultivation of cotton. This much must be emphasized. The population issue may well be the litmus test of one's ecological outlook, as the top honcho of Earth First, David Foreman, has declared. Greens, ecologically oriented people, and radicals of all kinds will have to solve this problem with an acute sense of the social, not by playing a numbers game with human life and clouding up that social sense with thoroughly unreliable statistical extrapolations and apologias for corporate interests. Nor can human beings be reduced to mere digits without reducing the world of life to digits, without replacing a decent regard for life, including human life, with a new eco-brutalism. Section 2. Before the 1970s, Malthusianism in its various historical forms claimed to rest on a statistically based formula that population increases geometrically while food supply increases merely arithmetically. At the same time, anti-Malthusians could refute the formula by using factual data. Arguments between Malthusians and their opponents were thus based on empirical studies and rational explorations of the proliferation of human beings, despite the failure of Malthusians to introduce social factors that could either promote or inhibit population growth. Anti-Malthusians could empirically inventory the food that was available and take practical measures to increase the supply. Food production could be assessed in terms of technological innovations that enhanced productivity. Land available for cultivation could be explored and put into production, often with minimal ecological damage. In short, pro- and anti-Malthusian arguments occurred within a rational arena of discourse and were subject to factual verification or refutation. Today, the situation seems to be changing radically. In an era of aggressive irrationalism and mysticism, empirical assessments are becoming increasingly irrelevant. The 1980s have seen the emergence of a mystical Malthusianism that does not draw on rationality to justify its own amorality and indifference to human suffering. The relationship between population and food is being thoroughly mystified. Herein lies a major problem in contemporary discussions on demographics. Often, in fact, mystical Malthusianism surfaces as a pious concern about the human suffering that could be alleviated in presumably overpopulated areas through population control measures. This view can be as sincere as it is naive. But taken still further, as it commonly is, it can shade into a more sinister demographic ethos that argues for keeping those populations that are sinking into chronic famine from climbing into and overloading the human lifeboat. Biocentrism and anti-humanism. If earlier discussions on population were anchored in rational discourse, the current crop of Malthusians tend to mystify the relationship between the population and the availability of food. Human beings are often seen as a cancer on the biosphere, a force for ecological dislocation and planetary destruction. The Earth, in turn, is deified into an all-presiding Gaia. Gaia is imparted with a mystical will and with divine powers that countervail abstract humanity, bereft of any social divisions. Gaia can then visit upon this socially undifferentiated us retributive acts like famine, war, and more currently in the Malthusian repertoire of vengeance, the AIDS epidemic. This view is not arguable, it's totally irrational. Cast in this sinister form, the eco-mystical neo-Malthusians of the post-60s era tend to reduce human misfortune and its social sources to an eco-theistic apocalypse. The traditional Malthusian numbers game gives way to a modern morality drama in which the social sources of hunger are eclipsed by ineffable supernaturalistic ones. All this is done in the name of a theistic version of ecology, one that ironically is grounded in a crudely anthropomorphic personification of the earth as a divinity. In principle, neo-Malthusians have long argued that people breed indefinitely, like lemmings, until they come up against natural limits imposed by the food supply. Biocentrism has provided a new wrinkle. The biocentric notion that human beings are intrinsically no different in worth from other animals lends a helping hand to Malthusianism. For after these natural limits are reached, Gaia dictates in some strange voice of her own that starvation and death must ensue until population is reduced to the carrying capacity of a particular region. By reducing social complexity to biological simple-mindedness, biocentrism's broad identification of the worth of human beings and the worth of non-humans denies to our species the enormous role that conceptual thought, values, culture, economic relationships, technology, and political institutions play in literally determining the carrying capacity of the planet on the one hand and in influencing human behavior in all its forms on the other. With startling mindlessness, socio-economic factors are once again erased, and their place is taken by a crude biologism that equates human intrinsic worth with that of lemmings, or, to use the animals of choice in the firmament of biocentrism, wolves, grizzly bears, cougars, and the like. Two very important conclusions emerge from such one-dimensional thinking. The first stems from the equitability of human with non-human beings in terms of their intrinsic worth. If human beings are no better intrinsically than lemmings, their premature death should at least be morally acceptable. Indeed, their death may even be biologically desirable in the cosmic scheme of things, that is, in order to keep Gaia on course and happy. Population control can then go beyond mere contraceptive advice to calculated neglect, fostering a permissible degree of famine and welcoming mass death from starvation. Such a situation occurred in Europe in the terrible Irish potato famine of the 1840s, when entire families perished due in no small part to Malthusian arguments against intervention in a natural course of events. Whether biocentrism's equation of the intrinsic worth of humans and lemmings will pave the ideological way to a future Auschwitz has yet to be seen, but the moral grounds for letting millions of people starve to death has been established with a vengeance, and it is arrogantly being advanced in the name of ecology. A second conclusion to which biocentrism lends itself is the deprecation of human intervention into nature as such. A blanket assumption exists among many biocentrists that human involvement in the natural world is generally bad and that Gaia knows best. With this mystical assumption of a knowing Gaia that has a suprahuman personality of its own, the earthquake that killed tens of thousands of Armenians could easily be justified as Gaia's response to overpopulation. Not surprisingly, assorted environmental groups that have made biocentrism a focal point in their philosophies tend towards a passive-receptive mysticism. Heidegger's numbing openness to being, Spinoza's fatalism, and various Asian theologies that enjoin us to yield to quietism have been used to becloud ecological issues with mystical overtones. We thus spin in an orbit of circular reasoning that subordinates human action to a supernatural world that is a product of human imagination. The result is that action as such becomes suspect, irrespective of the social conditions in which it occurs. Exactly at a time when we need the greatest clarity of thought and rational guidance to resolve the massive environmental dislocations that threaten the very stability of the planet, we are asked to bend before a completely mysterious will of Gaia that serves to paralyze human will and that darkens human perception with theistic shimmerers. The ability to clearly think out the contradictions this mentality produces is blocked by theistic appeals to a mysticism that places a ban on logic and reason. When a prominent ecological poet who has embraced deep ecology can claim, as he reportedly has, that for humanity to coexist with grizzly bears and redwood trees, California's population will have to be reduced to 1 million people, another dilemma confronts us. It is no longer even an area's material carrying capacity that is to determine the human population it can sustain. Carrying capacity itself is literally dematerialized and redefined in an eco-mystical way as wilderness, which acquires superhuman, even mysterious qualities of its own. No longer are people to crowd wilderness, rather wilderness is expected to crowd out people. This counterposition of primal wilderness to humanity and to humanity's social second nature is completely atavistic. The view pivots on a myth that humanity is a stranger to natural evolution, indeed that humanity's social second nature has no relationship to biology's presumably enchanted first nature. To the Enlightenment of 2 centuries ago, humanity, at least potentially, was the very voice of nature, and its place in nature utterly noble insofar as society was rational and humane. The mystical Malthusians. Today we are beginning to hear a new message. The human race could go extinct, declares Dave Foreman, and I for one would not shed any tears. Absurd as it may be, this message is not a rarity. Indeed, it is implicit in much of the thought that exists among the eco-mystics and eco-theists. What is important is that when grizzly bears can be placed on a par with human beings in the name of biocentrism, and I am surely not trying to make a case for the extermination of bears, we are witnessing not a greater sensitivity to life in general, but a desensitization of the mind to human agony, consciousness and personality, and to the potentiality of human beings to know and to understand that no other life form can approximate. In an era of sweeping depersonalization and irrationalism, the value of human personality and human rationality counts less and less. Reverence for nature, even respect for non-human life, provides no guarantee that humans will be included in the life-oriented mythos, the present crop of eco-mystics and eco-theists, to the contrary notwithstanding. The classical example of this is what Robert A. Pois has called an ingenuous permutation of mysticism in the Nazi movement. Nazism, alas, was more than ingenuous. Hitler's Mein Kampf registered the stern, indeed cosmic, view that this planet once moved through the ether for millions of years without human beings, and it can do so again someday if men forget that they owe their higher existence not to the ideas of a few crazy ideologists, but to the knowledge and ruthless application of nature's stern and rigid laws. Alfred Rosenberg, the ideologist par excellence of Nazism, railed against Jewish dualism and avowed a neo-pagan pantheism for a bridging of the gap between spirit and matter through the deification of nature, to cite Pois' summary. This kind of language can be found at varying levels of intensity in the writings of deep ecologists, eco-mystics and eco-theists today, who would certainly eschew any association with Nazism and who would avow their innocence in fostering the cultural legacy they are creating. Heinrich Himmler, who deployed the entire machinery of the SS in a vast operation to systematically kill millions of people, held this view with a vengeance. Man, he told his SS leaders in Berlin in June 1942, at the height of the Nazis' extermination operations, is nothing special. Ironically, his icy rejection of humanism found its fervent counterpart in his passionate love of animal life. Thus, Himmler complained to a hunter, one Felix Kirsten, "How can you find pleasure, Herr Kirsten, in shooting from behind cover at poor creatures browsing on the edge of a wood, innocent, defenseless, and unsuspecting? It's really pure murder. Nature is so marvelously beautiful, and every animal has a right to live." Such a passion for animal rights is often the opposite kind of the misanthropic coin. Indeed, hatred of humanity has often reinforced adulation of animals, just as hatred of civilization has often reinforced our hyper-sentimental naturalism. This shadowy side of superhuman naturalism suggests the perilous ground on which many eco-mystics, eco-theists, and deep ecologists are walking, and the dangers of desensitizing an already minimalized public, to use Christopher Lasch's term. As the late Edward Abbey's denunciations of Latin genetic inferiority and even Hebraic superstitions suggest, The mystical Malthusians themselves are not immune to the dangerous brew. The brew becomes highly explosive when it is mixed with a mysticism that supplants humanity's potentiality to be a rational voice of nature with an all-presiding Gaia, an ecotheism that denies human beings their unique place in nature. Reverence for nature is no guarantee of reverence for the world of life generally, and reverence for non-human life is no guarantee that human life will receive the respect it deserves. This is especially true when reverence is rooted in deification, and when a supine reverence becomes a substitute for social critique and social action. Demography and society. It was Marx who made the firm observation that every society has its own law of population. When the bourgeoisie needed labour in its early years to operate its industrial innovations, human life became increasingly sacred and the death penalty was increasingly reserved for homicidal acts. Before then, however, a woman in Boston had actually been hanged merely for stealing a pair of shoes. Today, in an era of automatic and automated devices, human life again tends to become cheap, all pieties about the horrors of war to the contrary notwithstanding. A social logic that involved depopulation, mingled with a pathological antisemitism, guided Hitler even more than his mystical naturalism. Demographic policy is always an expression of social policy and the type of society in which a given population lives. The most disquieting feature of deep ecology theorists, Earth First leaders, eco-mystics and eco-theists is the extent to which they nullify the importance of social factors in dealing with ecological and demographic issues, even as they embody them in some of their most mystified middle-class forms. This is convenient both in terms of the ease with which their views are accepted in a period of social reaction and in the stark simplicity of their views in a period of naivety and social illiteracy. William Peterson, a responsible demographer, has carefully nuanced what he calls some home truths about population in a recent issue of The American Scholar. Political factors, he points out, may play a larger role in recent famines than economic or even environmental ones. Mozambique, recently named the poorest country in the world, has a fertile soil, valuable ores, and a fine coastline, Peterson observes. That its GNP has fallen by half over the past 5 years and its foreign debt has risen by 2.3 billion, one must ascribe to its communist government and the destabilizing efforts of neighboring South Africa. Of the population of roughly 14 million, more than one person in 10 is a would-be refugee, on the road fleeing civil war but finding no refuge anywhere. Even more striking is the case of the Sudan, a land once celebrated for its agricultural fecundity. The Sudan is currently an appalling example of mismanagement, largely as a result of a British colonialist legacy of commitment to the cultivation of cotton and to World Bank loans for the development of agribusiness. Pressure by the bank for increased cotton production in the late 1970s to offset balance of payment problems, the impact of rising oil prices on highly mechanized agricultural practices, and a considerable decline in homegrown food reserves all combined to produce one of the most ghastly famines in northern Africa. The interaction of declining world prices for cotton, interference by the World Bank, and attempts to promote the sale of American wheat, a cereal that could have been grown in the Sudan if the country had not been forced to cultivate crops for the world market, claimed countless lives from hunger and produced massive social demoralization at home. This drama, usually explained by the Malthusians as evidence of the dangers of population growth, or by eco-mystics as an apocalyptic visitation by Gaia for presumably sinful acts of abuse to the earth, is played out throughout much of the Third World. Class conflicts, which may very well lie at the root of the populations that face hungry people, are transmuted by Malthusians into demographic ones in which starving country folk are pitted against impoverished townspeople and landless refugees against nearly landless cultivators of small plots, all of which immunizes the World Bank, American agribusiness, and a compradore bourgeoisie to criticism. Even in the first world, where demographic profiles reveal a growing proportion of older people over younger ones, lobbies like Americans for Generational Equity threaten to open a divide between recipients of Social Security and the young adults who presumably pay the bill. Almost nothing is said about the economic system, the corporations, or the madcap expenditures for armaments and research into life control that devour vast revenues and invaluable resources. Population may soar for reasons that have less to do with reproductive biology than with capitalist economics. Destroy a traditional culture, its values, beliefs, and sense of identity, and population increases may even outpace its high pre-industrial death rates. Life expectancy may even decline while absolute numbers of people rise significantly. This occurred during the worst years of the Industrial Revolution, amidst major tuberculosis and cholera pandemics, not to speak of monstrous working conditions that repeatedly thinned out the ranks of the newly emerging proletariat. Ecology, the carrying capacity of a region, and least of all Gaia, have very little to do with social demoralization and the breakdown of cultural restraints on reproduction. Economics and the exploitation of displaced agrarian folk are really the decisive factors, mundane as they may seem in the cosmic world of eco-mysticism and deep ecology. But conditions can stabilize and, given a higher quality of life, yield a relatively stable demographic situation. In more recent times, entirely new factors have emerged that may give rise to negative population growth. I refer not only to a desire for small families and more cultivated lifestyles, and concern for the development of the individual child rather than a large number of siblings, but above all, women's liberation movements and the aspirations of young women to be more than reproductive factories. In demographic transition, changes from traditional agrarian economies to modern industrial and urbanized ones involve a change from conditions of high fertility and mortality to those of low fertility and mortality. Demographic transition has been called by George J. Stolnitz, a cautious demographer, the most sweeping and best documented historical trend of modern times. What should be added to this conclusion is the need to improve the living conditions of people who make this transition, generally an improvement brought about by the labor movement and socially concerned educators, sanitarians, health workers, and radical organizations. If democratic transition has not occurred in the Third World, as a population bomber like David Brower has suggested, it is largely because semi-feudal elites, military satraps, and a pernicious domestic bourgeoisie have harshly repressed movements for social change. It is evidence of the incredible myopia and intellectual crudity of deep ecology, eco-mystics, and eco-theistic acolytes that the notion of demographic transition has recently been written off as inoperative, with no attempt to account for the festering shantytowns that surround some of the largest third world cities. Will ecology become a cruel discipline? Divested of its social core, ecology can easily become a cruel discipline. Neo-Malthusianisms, contemporary no less than earlier ones, often exhibited a meanness of spirit that completely fits into the Me Too yuppie atmosphere of the 80s. Consider the following passages from William Vogt's The Road to Survival, the work of an eminent biologist that was published a generation ago. Anticipating more recent prescriptions, he avowed, "Large-scale bacterial warfare would be an effective, if drastic, means of bringing back the Earth's forests and grasslands." And in a more thumping passage, well on into the book, he adds that the Food and Agricultural Organization of the United Nations should not ship food to keep alive 10 million Indians and Chinese this year, so that 50 million may die 5 years hence. A gothic generosity that recurs throughout the Malthusian literature of the 80s. These recipes essentially faded away as social unrest in the Third World itself surged up and rendered them untenable in the Cold War's demands for new political alignments abroad. The year 1968, however, was not only a climactic one in radical politics, but an initiating one in reactionary politics. In that year, perhaps one of the earliest manifestations of the move to the right was the publication and staggering popularity of Paul R. Ehrlich's The Population Bomb, which ran through 13 printings in only 2 years and gave birth to an army of population bombers. For deep ecologists like George Sessions and Bill Deval to praise Ehrlich as a radical ecologist verges on black humour. The book still reads like a hurricane on the loose, a maddening blowout of spleen and venom. From a sketch of human misery in Delhi in which people, the word is used sneeringly to open almost every sentence on the first page, are seen as visiting, arguing and screaming, as thrusting their hands through taxi windows, begging, defecating and urinating. Ehrlich and family seem to swoon with disgust over people, 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 people. We have a sense, one by no means felt by most of the book's American readers, that we have entered another world from Ehrlich's sublime campus at Stanford University. Thus it was, Ehrlich tells us, that he came to know the feel of overpopulation. In sum, attained a sense of disgust that pervades the entire work. Thereafter, our radical ecologist runs riot with his misanthropy. The third world is depersonalized into computer-age abbreviations like UDCs, underdeveloped countries. Medical advances are described as forms of death control, and pollution problems all can be traced to too many people. Terrifying scenarios engage in a ballet with each other that is strangely lacking in noticeable references to capitalism or to the impact of an ever-expanding grow-or-die market economy. Apart from the usual demand for increased tax burdens on those who breed excessively, contraception and educational work on family planning, a centerpiece of the book is Ehrlich's demand for a powerful governmental agency. Accordingly, a federal Department of Population and Environment should be set up with the power to take whatever steps are necessary to establish a reasonable population size in the United States and to put an end to the steady deterioration of our environment. The book enjoyed a great vogue, incidentally, during the Nixon administration. Lest we waver in our resolve, Ehrlich reminds us, the policeman against environmental deterioration must be the powerful Department of Population and Environment mentioned above. Happily for the business community, Ehrlich quotes one J.J. Spengler to the effect that it is high time, therefore, that business cease looking upon the stork as a bird of good omen. The population bomb climaxes in a favourable description of what is now known as the ethics of triage. Drawn from warfare, the idea briefly is this. When casualties crowd a dressing station to the point where all cannot be cared for by the limited medical staff, some decisions must be made on who will be treated. For this purpose, the triage system of classification was developed. All incoming casualties are placed in one of three classes. In the first class are those who will die, regardless of treatment. In the second are those who will survive, regardless of treatment. The third contains those who can be saved only if they are given prompt treatment. The presumption here is that the medical staff is limited and the diagnosis of a person is free of political considerations like the country's alignment in the Cold War. Among Neo-Malthusians, hardly any attempt is made to think out premises, indeed to ask what follows from a given statement. If all life forms have the same intrinsic worth as deep ecologists contend, can we impart to the malarial mosquitoes or the tsetse flies the same right to exist that we accord to whales and grizzly bears? Can a bacterium that could threaten to exterminate chimpanzees be left to do so because it too has intrinsic worth? And perhaps because human beings who can control a lethal disease of chimps should not interfere with the mystical workings of Gaia. Who is to decide what constitutes valid interference by human beings in nature and what is invalid? To what extent can conscious, rational and moral human intervention in nature be seriously regarded as unnatural, especially if one considers the vast evolution of life towards greater subjectivity and ultimately human intellectuality? To what extent can humanity itself be viewed simply as a single species when social life is riddled by hierarchy and domination, gender biases, class exploitation, and ethnic discrimination? Demography and society. The importance of viewing demography in social terms is all the more apparent when we ask, would the grow-or-die economy of capitalism cease to plunder the planet if the world's population were reduced to a tenth of its present numbers? Would lumber companies, mining concerns, oil cartels and agribusiness render redwood and Douglas fir forests safer for grizzly bears if, given capitalism's need to accumulate and produce for their own sake, California's population were reduced to 1 million people? The answer to these questions is a categorical no. Vast bison herds were exterminated on the western plains long before the plains were settled by farmers or used extensively by ranchers. Indeed, when the American population barely exceeded some 60 million people, these great herds were not crowded out by human settlements, let alone by excessive population. We have yet to determine what constitutes the carrying capacity of the planet for even larger human populations, just as we lack any certainty, given the present predatory economy, about what constitutes a strictly numerical balance between reduced human numbers and a given ecological area. All the statistics that are projected by demographers today are heavily conditioned by various values that remain unexplored, such as the desire of some people for pristine wilderness, or even mere open land, a pastoral concept of nature, and a love of cultivated land. Indeed, human taste has varied so widely over the centuries with respect to what constitutes nature that we may well ask whether it is ever natural to exclude the human species, a distinct product of natural evolution, from our conceptions of the natural world, including from so-called pristine wilderness areas. This much seems reasonably clear. A wilderness that has to be protected from human intervention is already a product of human intervention. It is no more wild if it has to be guarded than an Aboriginal culture is truly authentic if it has to be shielded from the impacts of civilization. We have long since left the remote world when purely biological factors determined evolution and the destiny of most species on this planet. Until these problematic areas that influence modern thinking on demographics are clarified and their social implications, indeed underpinnings, are fully explored, the Neo-Malthusians are operating in a theoretical vacuum and filling it with extremely perilous ideas. Indeed, it is a short step from writing anti-Semitic letters to Jewish furriers in the name of animal rights to scrawling swastikas on Jewish temples and synagogues. Eco-mystics, eco-theists, and deep ecologists create a very troubling situation when they introduce completely arbitrary factors into discussions on demographics. Gaia becomes whatever one chooses to make of her, demonic avenger or loving mother, homeostatic mechanism or mystical spirit, a personified deity or a pantheistic principle. In all of these roles, she can easily be used to advance a misanthropic message of human self-hatred, or worse, a hatred of specific ethnic groups and cultures, with consequences that cannot be foreseen even by her most loving, well-meaning, and pacific acolytes. It is this utterly arbitrary feature of eco-mystical and eco-theistic thinking, often divested of all social content, that makes most new paradigm discussions of the population issue not only very troubling, but potentially very sinister.